There's kind of an old joke that went like this. Between Henry Aaron and myself, between the two of us, we have hit 715 home runs. And, of course, when I say that, Henry hit them all, and I hit none. Now, why that story fits this is, between Wayne Grudem and I, we have talked to huge audiences. I don't think that anybody in the audience, not one, came to hear me. Wayne, I've told you, I've used this word. He hates it when I say it this way because but he's a rock star. In Albania, in China, in Peru, in South America, in Africa, Wayne was a rock star. And I just got to go along for the ride. When it comes to this book, I feel the same way. I worked very hard, but Wayne has a beautiful touch. So, man, am I appreciative for him. And thank you for coming out on a Sunday morning. Three silly stories. Silly story number one. A cat died and went to heaven. St. Peter met him at the gate and said, "You are a great cat. We're going to give you anything you want." And he said, She said, "I want a big, pink, fluffy pillow." And St. Peter says, "Terrific. It's yours." Six mice died. They also were good mice. Could have anything they wanted. And they said, "We each want a skateboard." Terrific. So one day St. Peter is walking through heaven and he sees the cat with her big beautiful pillow. "How are you enjoying your pillow?" She says, "I love it. And oh, by the way, the meals on wheels are delicious." So that's joke number. Number two is two Eskimos were in a kayak freezing to death. They lit a little fire in the bottom of the kayak. It burned a hole in it, and it sank. So the moral of that story is, you can't have your kayak and heat it too. Okay. Third story. Gandhi was a famous Indian leader, philosopher, guru. Gandhi almost never wore shoes, so he had big calluses on his feet. Gandhi was a very fragile man, very thin, didn't eat very much. Gandhi ate a diet, though, that gave him perpetual bad breath. So is there one word that we could use to describe Gandhi? Yes? Yes, there is a word. He was a super calloused, fragile mystic hexed by halitosis. That's a lot of words. There are so many difficulties, not only in the world, but in our own country today, that literally any one of them could take an hour of discussion. You all know we've got debt, deficits, unfunded liabilities in Social Security, unfunded liabilities in Medicare that are horrific numbers. We have now 50 million Americans on food stamps receiving an all-time high $10,000 a year, and Obama said we can't kick them off, so they're on permanently. So we are developing a permanent entitlement class for food stamps. We have a healthcare program that's being released that is total chaotic because it doesn't solve any one of the problems that we have in healthcare. The only thing that can do that is a competitivized healthcare system and selling insurance across state lines and doing tort reform, and doing health savings accounts, blah, blah, blah. No, 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 no. No, no, we're going to go to a single-payer, government-run healthcare system. So this is what Obama wants, and this is apparently what he's going to try to get. So that's a whole subject in itself. So we could go on and on, none the least to say all of our moral and the cultural rot that is going on in our society. So that whole subject deserves all kinds of attention also. I feel that you get to hear a lot of that on television and get to see a lot of that and discuss a lot of that. And so I said to Wayne, Wayne, you know what I'd like to do, if you think you would give me permission to do this, is I would like to say, share some ideas that are some good news, some good things that are happening that you can be encouraged about. Wayne said, fine, do that. Make sure you anchor it in some scripture. So I would say this, that without question, with all the problems that we have, especially the cultural and spiritual problems, that it starts with you and it starts with me. And so if we don't have love, by your love for each other, they will know you are my disciples. And so Jesus, Matthew 22 is very clear, to love God with all our heart, mind, and soul, and our neighbor as ourself. The Bible is clear on where God wants us to stand on love. Though I speak with the tongues of men and angels and have not love, I've become as a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. Though I have the gift of prophecy and can understand all mysteries and all knowledge and have not love, it's worth nothing. Though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, though I even give my body to be burned and have not love, it amounts to nothing. So the Apostle Paul says that love is patient, love is kind, love is neither anxious to impress, nor does it cherish inflated ideas of its own importance. In other words, love is humble. Indeed, love is humble. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. If there is the gift of prophecy, it'll pass away. If there's the gift of tongues, it shall also shall pass. For now we know in part, but then we shall know even as we are known. When I was a child, I thought as a child, I understood as a child, I talked as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. For now we just know in part, but then we shall know even as we are known. And now abides faith, hope, and love, and the greatest of these is love. Bible, Jesus, very clear on where love stands. If we don't love each other, then we don't know God, because God is love. So it starts there and it ends there. And so no matter what happens in our nation, no matter the cultural rot, no matter the numbers going down, the number of church attenders, and on, numbers not looking very good, despite all of that, it seems like one has to stop, look in the mirror, and say, it starts here. It starts here with me. And it starts with love, loving my wife, loving my children, loving my family, but certainly loving my brothers and sisters in Christ. And then, maybe most important of all, is loving that which is very unlovable. That's kind of hard for me, and I'll be honest with you, it's hard. But it's why I love to hang around young life people. I've been doing it for 51 years. Mandy and I have been involved in young life. And young life has got its strengths. Young life has got its weaknesses. But I know what its main strength is. Young life leaders know how to love on the unlovely. And I call the unlovely people that are between the ages of 14 and 20. They are pretty unlovely sometimes. And parents know that you have to love your kids the most when they deserve it the least. And I think between the ages of 14 and 20 are sometimes the ages when they deserve it the least. And so it is just always joyous to see a kid come into a Young Life club. He's got enough hardware on his face. He looked like his face is dropped into a tackle box. And this kid I'm thinking of had his hair shaved on this side, totally shaved, and this side down to his ankles. So that's quite a combo. Shaved this side down to his ankles, full of things. I mean, just offhand, he's not the kid. Yes, I just love that kid. But to see Young Life leaders love on that guy is just a joy. And they do it all the time, every time. They know how to love on the unlovely. I certainly wanting to learn that lesson in my own heart. When I run up against people that are diametrically opposed to what I believe, my first instance is not to want to like them very well, but Jesus would say, love them, love them. Throw love on them because they can be changed through love. And I really believe that. The rest of my presentation this morning is not meant to be through rose-tinted glasses. I want to give it to you the best I can, but I want to say it this way. Anytime you're in a moral fight for a country, anytime you're in values, fighting for the values of a country, it is not a short-term battle, and it has nothing to do with the next election. Understand that we're in this for the long term, that this fight is for the long term, and it's going to be well worth the fight because we're going to win. We're going to win in the end. It just doesn't look very good at different moments of our time. If you brought the founding fathers out of their graves and they could see the condition of America as it is, they would say our worst dreams have come true. James Madison, who wrote much of the Constitution of the United States, said, we've designed this government to protect freedom from democracy and the individual from the majority. Our founding fathers knew that democracy was fundamentally unstable. Our founding fathers knew that when 51% of the people can vote to take everything that the 49 have produced, they knew that is not going to work, but they knew it was going to happen. So knowing that that is what's coming up, a government where no one pays in taxes, but everybody wants to take out, there's two ways to make a living. One way is work. The other way is vote or stealing. And stealing is a great labor-saving device. So our founding fathers knew that, so they worked all, as hard as they could to prevent that. Three houses of government. Why? To limit government. State government versus federal government. Why? To limit government. A constitution of the United States full of delegations and enumerations. Federal government, these are your delegated powers, no more. Federal government, these are your enumerated powers, no more. What were the founding fathers doing? Limit government. Limit government. They knew that a democracy is always is like two wolves and one sheep voting on what we're going to have for dinner. They knew that the takers could overwhelm the makers. So the founding fathers had that all together. They designed the system, and lo and behold, here we are, where we've come to the entitlement state, where we not only want $10,000 worth of food stamps, but we want to be able to spend that money on anything that we want. If we want to spend it on booze and whatever, that's fine too. And we don't want any end to this. We want to make sure that this is going to be increased. And so it's Obama's idea to probably increase food stamps something like 10% a year, just so we can have fairness. Well, be that as it may, that's where we are today. Troubling, to say the least. Okay, what's the good news? The good news is we have churches like this one who are not only have the graciousness and the charity to say we can make a bigger and stronger campus, that we can take special needs from X number to 2X to 3X, that we can seat instead of 1,600 people, we'll seat 2,400 people, and. We can put up a chapel on the corner of Miller and Shea that 16, 18, 20,000 cars that go by, and that I think that chapel will be the key piece of Scottsdale Bible Church. I think it'll be manned 24 hours a day. I think when people are driving by, they know exactly where McDonald's is, they know exactly where Jack in the Box is, but nobody knows a church is even over here. They will see that chapel, they will see that moment in time, and they will drop in, and that can be our biggest evangelical piece on this campus, is to have that active and alive as people see a church with a cross, knowing that the fundamental problem of all of us is brokenness, the fundamental problems of all of us is sin, and there's no other way other than mercy there was great and grace was free. Pardon there was multiplied to me. There my burdened soul found liberty. Where? At Calvary. Where? At the cross. Where? At the feet of Jesus. That's where. And that's what this campus and this corner can begin to represent to many people that don't even know this place exists. It can be, take them to the feet of Jesus. Take them to the cross. So my point there is, I am so grateful that the congregation has backed the church leadership that this is what we're going to do. And we're all going to be able to see this 5 years from now. I mean, hopefully this 16 and a half acres campus is going to be vibrating 7 days a week. Hopefully Saturdays will be even a bigger day than Sundays, and on, because we will have the facility to do that very thing. So, to me, I just get excited about what God has planned for Scottsdale Bible Church. But it's not just Scottsdale Bible Church. To travel the valley and see the larger churches and see those campuses, your heart just sings for joy. Oh God, you have worked and are working in every piece of this valley. This little piece here is our share. This is what, not our share, but our responsibility. So we would want to do the best job on this 16 acres as we possibly can. The other campuses that I've visited are as many as 50 acres, some of them even 100 acres. So it's amazing how what you can do on 100 acres. But we decided we're just not going to buy more land, except for that little piece out here on Quasa Buena, out on the corner of Miller and Shea, and that's where that chapel will go. So we're going to be part of the religious revival and want to be, and I don't mean when it's all built, I mean now. I think we can have more evangelization going on even during the build out than any. Look, God does not need buildings, he needs us. Starts with you, starts with me. Okay. What are some of the bright spots in America? Friends, if you would have told me, last 60 years, here's oil importing up and up and up. In fact, 12 years ago, we were importing 65% of our oil. 65%. And if you would have told me, what's it going to be in 2013? I'd have said 75%. What's it going to be in 2020? It's going to be 80%. Where are we going here? We're using more and more oil, and we need more and more oil, and therefore we have to import more and more oil. If you would have told me 12 years ago that we were going to have an oil revolution, if you'd have told me that not only are imports not going up, but by 2013, we will be importing less than 40% compared to 65%, less than 40%, and it's going to go down every year for about the next 12, 15 years, and we are going to be a net energy exporter. If someone would have told me that the United States would be the Saudi Arabia of coal, I would believe it, because we do have more coal than any other nation. If someone would have told me we could be the Saudi Arabia of gas, I would have thought, thought that is a possibility, although I don't know where we're digging for all our gas right now. But yes, we are a great gas producer. But if someone would have told me we'll be the Saudi Arabia oil, I'd say it cannot be, it won't be. You got to be kidding. But it is going to be the truth. Already, we're very close to being the Saudi Arabia of oil. Now, all of you know why this has happened, a new technique to use, they call it fracking, to dig down to 7, 8, 9,000 feet instead of stopping at 3,000 feet and pulling the oil there. We go down to 9,000 feet and you get down to that distance and there's a big hard shale. It's like a big eggshell, a big eggshell. It's called shale. And if you can just crack that eggshell somehow, it releases enormous amounts of oil and natural gas. So what's happened is we thought that the Bakken field in North Dakota was going to be a gas field. They went down, bam, instead of just gas, it's oil like you can't believe. In fact, there's probably more oil in the Bakken field than in Alaska. So a gusher of oil. Then they said, hey, we can go back to all those oil wells that we dug in Texas, Oklahoma. We can re-drill those down the same hole, but we'll go down to 8,000 feet instead of stopping at 3, and we'll frack that shale down there. And lo and behold, Texas is producing more oil now than almost it's ever produced in the history of Texas. Oil at Oklahoma is doing the same thing. So my point is, we are becoming a great oil and gas producer. In fact, we'll be the biggest oil and gas and coal producer in the world. We'll be exporting tons of it, and I can't tell you the economic ramifications of that statement. Because the fact is this, from the beginning of time until the year almost 1900, I could take it just to 1800, I'll take it to 1900. The reason why I'll go from the beginning of time to 1900 is because this is when oil begins to happen. But poverty, that's all we've seen, that's all the world. Poverty is the natural condition. Poverty is easy. You don't have to work very hard to be in poverty. Just sit on your butt. Poverty. Perfect. Poverty is easy, but wealth production is hard. But all through this period of time, how do we do wealth production? Oxes, horsepower, man's muscle power, a little bit of wind power, a little bit of hydropower, but that's it. That's it. And that just has huge, huge limitations. But once you get to fossil fuel, with fossil fuel, now you can put one man on a 45-foot wide John Deere self-propelled combine, and this one person can do the work of 5,000 men. Now you can put one person in a diesel train on the engine and pulling 100 cars behind him, and that one man with that diesel engine can do the work of 50 or 100,000 men. Now, folks, when you begin talking this way, now you're talking productivity. And so way even before the fossil fuel, we began to learn that specialization is so important. Yes, we can come into a pin factory and you make a pin or two or three pins a day, and you make two or three or four pins a day, and you make it. But if we divide up the task to make a pin, it takes 18 steps. Make the steel, pull the steel, cut the steel, sharpen the steel, put that pin head on there, which is a technique all to itself, etc., etc. There are 18 steps to make a pin. If we'll divide that task up and you do the pulling of the steel, you do the cutting of the steel, you do the sharpening of the steel, you put the head on, blah, 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 that's called specialization. You go to specialization. Now, all of a sudden, these 10 people are making 28,000 pins a day instead of 50 pins a day. Specialization. Specialization. See, as Wayne and I have got to travel the world, I'm telling you that most of the world does not understand this. Well, most of the world, even today, is what? Subsistence farmers. Now, figure that out. What does subsistence farming mean? It means that you do the plowing, you do the cultivating, you do the harrowing, you do the planting, you do the harvesting, you do the manufacturing of the harvest after it's all done. That's what subsistence is. I'll do it all. Thank you. Wait, stop. Break it into a million tasks. Let everybody specialize and trade, specialize and trade. Just like we've done this pin factory. We're giving each one of you a certain task in the pin factory, and now we can make 30,000 pins on a day instead of only 100 pins in a day. Specialization and trade. So sometimes the world doesn't know because it has never heard. And so it has to hear the message of specialization and trade. And to be honest with you, when Wayne and I started this book, we had no intention of having 3 out of the 9 chapters being about economics. Because we talked about that from the beginning. I says, Wayne, I don't want to do any economics. I'll do some economics. But we got going, and then we started traveling and finding out the paucity of information, the minimal of information, of people understanding what makes the world work and how do you increase wealth. Because the only answer for poor countries is that for every person to produce more, to every person to get more productive. And if they don't, they'll be in poverty forever. Certainly, it has way more than just an economic component. It has a spiritual component. Look at, we all can go to Haiti till we're blue in the face. We can give Haiti $1 million this year, $10 million this year, $10 billion this year, $100 billion this year. I'm telling you, you'll never pull Haiti out of poverty. Why? Because they're voodoo. Everything about voodooism is progress resistant. Everything. Every detail of their religion is progress resistant. In other words, there's no way to ever make Haiti prosperous if they're going to stick with voodooism. Now, it's our good fortune, but everything about the Judeo-Christian religion is progress prone, not progress resistant, but everything about our religion is progress prone. The day counts. The hour counts. It's important to save. It's important to invest. It's important to work hard. It's blah, blah, blah. Yes, yes, and yes again. Everything as we walk through our religion. So Judeo-Christian is so progress prone. Now, can there be, well, I'm not going to go into it. Can you overdo that? I mean, can all of a sudden material well-being become your very essence? We say it on the first page of our book, and we say it on the last page of our book. If you think that we think that the essence of life is prosperity, that the essence of life is to get rich, you've missed it. We're not saying that at all. But we are saying that if you keep doing Haiti, you keep doing South America, you keep doing Africa, Africa, for heaven's sakes, you've been doing socialism now for 50 years. From 1950 to the year 2000, every country, 55 countries in Africa, all doing socialism. We've got some news for you. It doesn't work. Public ownership of the means of production does not create the right incentives for human beings to work. And they won't. And so you can try socialism till you're blue in the face. Finally, as we've come into the 21st century, Africa, the needle is beginning to move a bit, and the needle is beginning to see that it's really the free market that they have to do. China, folks, China has been in dire poverty for 5,000 years, for crying out loud. I mean, China, all through the last centuries, I mean, stuck in poverty. Communism didn't help when Mao Zedong took over China. But even right up almost through the 80s, 1.2 billion people stuck in dire, making $1 a day, $2 a day poverty. It doesn't get worse than that. And all of a sudden, you have Deng Xiaoping taking over when Mao Zedong died, and he began to say, hey, I don't care if it's the cat's white or the cat's black. I care that the cat knows how to catch mice. And obviously, communism does not know how to catch mice. It's not doing it. So if we have to move to free market, we will, and they did. And so starting in 1977, China, the needle began to switch. How? Economic freedom, that's how. Allow people to move where they want, allow people to own, allow people to hire, allow people to fire, allow people to create, allow people to save, allow people to invest, blah, 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 blah. Economic freedoms, capitalism, economic freedoms, capitalism, economic freedom, capitalism. But Wayne and I felt we couldn't use the word capitalism because people hate capitalism. So every country we went, if you're going to talk about capitalism, count us out. Because our feeling is capitalism is evil. Okay, okay. If it's picked up that kind of a name, then let's drop the word and let's start talking about free market. The point is, the world lived on a different kind of a power system until you get to fossil fuel, and you get to fossil fuel, and all of a sudden, the productivity and the wealth of countries take off. Well, all countries now can have some electricity and some fossil fuel wealth. Not just a few, all. So is the prognosis, let's put it this way. The 20th century ended with half of the world's population in dire poverty. The 21st century will end with almost all of the world's population living moderately well. Living moderately well because, one, China has kind of come to its senses. Not as far as politics, not as far as spiritual freedom. No, no, I admit it. It's terrible. But they've come to their senses as far as economic freedom. And when you allow some economic freedom, you allow the incentives for people to produce. So China will become a miracle. All of Africa is going to become a miracle. South America will be the last of all the areas of the world that become a miracle. They've got a little miracle in Chile. Chile has been trying free market, limited government ideas since 1975. And they went 20 years, very strong free market, and Chile, the only bright spot in South America. The only bright spot. But Chile, in the meantime, has elected socialist after socialist after socialist, and now right back down again. So will Chile come to their senses? I hope so. But South America is so envious of their North American neighbor. We live so much, think about it. You go to San Diego and you go 2 miles into Tijuana. And it's like you're going into another world. You're in El Paso, Texas, and you go across the border. Come on. I mean, no matter where you go along the border, it's just like two worlds right next to each other. How can one world be so poor and the other be so rich? Well, I'll tell you why. It's because white Anglos are so darn smart. No, I'm just teasing. Of course not. Of course not. You have to do some right things. Specialize. Trade and go to free markets and let the markets work and create incentives. And when you reward an economic activity, you get more of it. When you penalize an economic activity, you get less. Blah, 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 blah. But Wayne and I, one of our first messages to the world, poor world, especially South America, and they don't get it. We've tried this in Argentina. We've tried this in Mexico. We've tried this in Peru. And then I've been in other countries in South America. They don't get it. So here's what I'm going to say. We say to them, and they sit there. You say to them, listen. The poor people of the world have some housing. That's you all. Act like you're South America now. You're a Guatemalan, you're a Peruvian, you're an Argentinian, you're a Brazilian. You're somewhere in South America. So here's the message to you now. So, poor people of the world have some housing, and you do. Some of it's very poor, straw, tin buildings, etc. But you have some housing. But here's the problem. You don't have a title to that housing. Now, we're going to get to why that's so important in just a second. The poor people of this world grow some crops. You do. But you don't have a deed to those crops. The poor people of this world run some small little businesses. And you do. But you don't have articles of incorporation. What's the deal here? What's the deal here? The deal here is this. Without titles, deeds, and articles of incorporation, you don't have a property document. When Mandy and I buy a home, they give us a document that says, this is the mortgage, this is your deed, this is the date, this is the address, this is the phone number, this is who we're talking about, Barry and Mandy Asmus, and we have a property document that we own that home. How do we use that property document? If I ever had to borrow $50, I'd go to the banker. I'd like to borrow $50. And he would say, what? What's your collateral? What are you going to back? How can I be protected? You want me to lend you $1,000? How am I going to protect my $1,000? Here's how. We can do a second mortgage on this first mortgage. Oh, you mean then we'll use the value of your home as collateral against me? Bingo! That's what poor people are unable to do. Poor people of this world cannot get collateralized. And without collateral, you're dead. You're dead. And so that's the message that we get to share with group after group and people after people. But I have to tell you, at the end of 20 hours of lectures, the Peruvians just looked and said, I still don't like capitalism. I still don't like, capitalism's evil. Capitalism is greedy. No way would God want us to be in an economic system called capitalism. Well, do you think God maybe would like us to be in a free market? Do you think when God says in Genesis 1, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, exercise stewardship and ownership over everything that moves on this earth, do you think maybe God had in mind that he would want us to be prosperous? Do you think maybe since God is the creator, he would like us to exercise our creative gifts and also be creative? Do you think we're being like God, more like God when we exercise that creative gifts? Is there anything wrong with innovation? In other words, South America, so is what you're saying this? What we're trying to say is life is better than death, health is better than sickness, education is better than illiteracy, that prosperity is better than poverty. That's what we're saying. But apparently what you're saying is death is better than life. Indeed. You go to Peru, to the Peruvian, the Amazon River people, they only live to age 25, and the sociologists in Peru say, leave them alone. Well, they're all dying of polio. They're all dying of malaria. Almost all the babies that are born are dying at birth. So what you're saying is death is better than life. What do you say? Death is better than life. Poverty is better than prosperity. Slavery is better than freedom. Illiteracy is better than education. Excuse me. So South America maybe will come to senses somehow, some way, but I see it being most resistant to wanting to change to an environment where they can create prosperity. The second one behind that, well, obviously Muslim, my. But let me encourage you. There's a family coming here now, a Muslim family. One of our big touch points is in Wales, which is right next to England, and that Wales Christian Church has an unbelievable outreach to Muslims. And Tom Chard and I got to spend a week at that church last November, and we were so blessed by how many Muslim families that church was ministering. Now, this is not going to blow you away because they don't have magic. All they do is love on them. That's complicated, isn't it? That's really love on them? Muslims? Yeah. And so I got to be with about 15 Muslim kids in their 20s all heading off. The church was having a little weekend retreat on the coast. In Wales, it's easy to get to the coast. Half-hour drive, you're on the coast. But anyway, go and have a neat weekend retreat. And we got to see them leave, and then we got to see them when they came back. So they came back on a Saturday morning, and I just wanted to be there when the bus got back, and I just wanted to visit with those Muslim adults in their 20s about how the weekend went and what they learned and what was meaningful to them. I'm telling you, they can be open to the gospel of Christ. They're as needy as we are. They're as broken as we are. They have the same spiritual needs as we do, for heaven's sakes. But what you had is you had a group of Wales Christians just loving on them, serving them good food, having lots of fun, playing games on the beach, and so on, and then having wonderful times of discussion. So that certainly would be your dream. This class is going to make that a dream come true. And we have a number of classes that are already ministering to Muslim families. Indeed, love on people. Love on people. And understand that the battle we have is not the next election. The battle we have takes decades and decades. So we've got to be willing to dig in and fight the good fight, spread the good news of Christ, have this church do its fair share of ministering to the world. Its fair share. And I'm very biased to Fred Beasley. I'm just very biased with him. But everything that I've watched Fred do in Argentina and in the Mideast and in Tanzania and in other places in the world, I'm moved. God, in my opinion, has anointed Fred in a unique way. The interesting thing is, here's how you find out if you're a leader. Start leading. And if anybody's following, you might be a leader. If no one's following, you're not much of a leader. Fred says, I need 16 guys to go to Romania for this building program. And lo and behold, here in just a few days, 16 guys are going to get on the plane at Sky Harbor and head over to Romania and do this. They did this around the world. He's just able to do it. God has blessed Scottsdale Bible Church with someone like Fred. But I tell you what, you don't know maybe even better blessing than that, and that's Margie Galloway. Margie, I swear she could start a Domino's Club on Wednesday afternoon, and she would have 250 women who would want to join her at the Domino Club. I mean, she leads by example. She loves on people. She listens to people. And it's a ministry that just, the women's ministry at our church just sweeps me away. I just say, oh God, we don't deserve leadership like this. And yet, we have it. Well, I'm not going to go on and on about the Scottsdale Bible Church, but we have a great continuing opportunity to evangelize and love on people. And when I hear reports like I did this morning about this Muslim family coming, love on them. Love on them. Love on them. That's what we have to do. Energy equals the economy. The economy equals energy. When you start solving the energy problem, folks, when you have electricity, then you can, through electrolysis, have clean water. When you have clean water, then you have less waterborne diseases. And it just all fits like a hand in a glove. You need clean water. You need something other than searching the world for wood and chopping that wood up and coming and using that wood to heat your home or to cook off of and the smoke thereof. So One electric grill would literally save the world's forests. Then we wouldn't be burning all the wood to create heat and light. Can we have the electric grill? Yes. Was it more difficult when you generated electricity using a 1,000-megawatt coal-fired generating plant? Yes, that's a $3 billion operation. Was it hard to get electricity when you have to use a 1,000 or 2,000-megawatt plant like we've got 40 miles out of town. A nuclear plant? Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty. But what if you could generate electricity with a little, small, 10-megawatt gas turbine? In other words, you burn natural gas in this to generate the electricity. Really? In other words, it's possible that all kinds of African villages, if they just would have some access to just one well, and they probably do, because you go down there, and it's amazing how many countries have shale oil, a little oil, but a 10-megawatt plant. Indeed. So it's scalable. Energy, electricity has become scalable. So we're going to see more of it throughout the world. And when we see more of it, we will see less disease, less death. Is that noise coming from me? Or is it just? Am I just the one hearing that? Is this annoying? Is it driving you crazy? No. Okay. So, energy, beautiful. Now, watch this next argument. The world is urbanizing. The world does not want to live on the farm. Thank goodness. We're living on the farm, as I was born and raised on an eastern Colorado farm, let me tell you, I mean, for sure when I was 18, I knew what I didn't want to do when I became a man. And that's milk 6 cows in the morning and milk 6 cows in the evening, 365 days a year. That's what I knew I didn't want to do. I would much rather ski, play tennis, go camping, then milk cows in the morning. But the whole world is that way. The whole world says, no, we want to urbanize. We want to move into the city. Now, here's the miracle about moving people together. The real wealth of a nation is its people, their ideas, and their creativity. When you push them together, all kinds of synergistic and wonderful things happen as compared to keeping them separate and apart. The world is figuring it out. They want to urbanize, so they need roads and rails and ports and airports, etc., etc., precisely. They need lots of steel. They need lots of coal. They need lots of cement and concrete, of course. They need some soft technology like education, and then a lot in the whole the technological world and the knowledge world. And all of that is very, very much not only a strong possibility, but a strong probability. America will be at the very hub of being one of the main facilitators and traders of what the world as it urbanizes needs. Because, isn't it interesting, in this whole technological, software, information age world, wouldn't you know that America was the very heart of all that? Who's the heart of tablet PCs? Who's the heart of business networking? Who's the heart of what our kids use a lot, social networking? Who's the heart of robotics? Who's the heart of laser technology? Who's the heart of 3D printing? Who's the heart? It keeps coming right back, the United States. This seems to be the vibrant intellectual center for the whole development of the software revolution. And that's where exactly the knowledge world is going. The knowledge economy driven by the software world, and most of that comes here. Because we're smarter? No. But because we have had a religion from day one that says change is okay. I mean, if you're the president of India and you're going to build some railroads, and you feel to build those railroads, it would be helpful to have wheelbarrows. And so you order in tens of thousands of wheelbarrows to do all this heavy lifting of steel and gravel and wood to make railroads, and no one will use the wheelbarrows. They put it all on their head in a basket. I mean, what do you say? Well, you don't say anything. That's what you want to do. So in other words, it's going to take 10 of us with baskets on our heads to do what one of us could do with a wheelbarrow. So we were born into this caste, and we're going to stay in this caste. And oh, by the way, don't try to convince any of us that we should become business people, that we should become marketeers, that we should become people in that. No, no, that's not our caste. In fact, the caste that I'm in right now is higher than that one, because they hold business and people in the trades to be as low as people in their lowest castes. No change. No change. So there's what you're dealing with in a Hindu world. They don't want change. You've been born to that caste. You should stay in that caste. We, in America, anybody that comes from anywhere with education, without education, whatever, they can make choices. We give them economic freedom. And interestingly, most of them will make something out of their lives. Unless, of course, you give them free entitlements. And if you're going to give them things for free, it destroys the soul, it destroys the incentive, and then you live a life that you're going to live on entitlements. Entitlement. That's what we're doing with this nonsense of 50 million people being on food stamps, but be that as it may. That's what we're doing with free healthcare, saying that, oh, we're going to bring 30 million people now into the healthcare system. Not one new doctor, but, are you ready for the good news? 16,000 new IRS agents. I go to bed at night thinking, that's what I've always dreamed, that someone would have the vision for 16,000 new IRS, Internal Revenue Service people, who can monitor you, control you, manage you, watch how you spend your money, and make sure that you have the insurance that we decided you should have at the price that we should divide. And oh, you thought you'd choose your doctor? Forget that. No, we're going to do that a little differently too. Oh, and you thought you could select some insurance? No, we're going to do that. That's where we're going. That's why I lay in bed and my eyes get this big sometimes. And that's when I have to once again come and say, my job is to love. My job is to say, is to pray that beautiful prayer that Jesus prayed in Acts when he said, Father, Father, I pray that they might be one as you and I are one, so that the world knows that God sent the Son. When we love, loving our neighbor as ourselves, showing love, God says, now, that's my will. That's my will for you to do that. So in conclusion, what some bright spots I see for America is our wonderful, wonderful energy picture, and there's no way to describe all the benefits that come from having the kind of energy that we have and will have. Secondly, as the world urbanizes, they need the skill sets and the technology and some of the education that we're very good at owning and dispensing and sharing and trading. So that fits. For whatever reason, I would have thought maybe a lot of the technological revolution would have happened in where? well, you name the place, but the more I think about it, it's not going to be China, because Chinese are not particular innovators. Chinese are followers. Chinese are great mathematicians because their whole mathematical system is conducive to being very, very smart in math. But a pictorial language really limits you. A pictorial language would have a hard time saying what we did about Gandhi in one word: a super calloused, fragile, mystic, hexed, a halitosis. In the English language, I mean, just the word fast has at least 10 meanings. And you know exactly what I meant. I think this week I'm going to fast. I think you know what I mean. I think if I said, this lady is, she's kind of known as, she's fast, you probably know what that means. And I look at this guy back here, a stud athlete, and say, he can run fast, and you know what that means. And so you could keep using fast, fast, fast. My button is on there, it's holding fast. You know what that means. Is this weird? Is this, I mean, how would someone ever learn to use this language? You just says my button is on there and holds fast, like it's, what do you, see what I mean? But we know, don't we? So now imagine using our language with all that multiple of meanings and the way we can draw out stories as compared to a pictorial language. My son-in-law is Chinese. And I've never enjoyed anybody so much in my life. One, I don't know how to cook. He's a fabulous cook. And I could just sit in the kitchen and watch him with fruits, vegetables, and meats and slicing and dicing. And I just sit and say, oh, my gosh. But he doesn't just slice. He loves on it. He loves on the food. He loves on the food. He goes into a restaurant and he orders off the menu and he looks at about 10 selections. Then he asks the waitress, what about this one? I don't even look at the menu. I order the same thing at the same restaurant at the same time, and I've been doing that for 30 years. I mean, cheese enchilada, that's as far as I take it. And so it's just silly. But my son-in-law, so I can say 1,000 good things about him, including he loves my daughter and treats her so beautifully and treats her so tenderly and carefully and so respectfully. I love him for the fact that when Paul talks, he says, I'll pray about that. Paul has used that phrase with me at least 1,000 times. I'll pray about that. And he does pray about that. So I say, God, where did you find this guy? Okay, that's the good news. The bad news is that he lived in a family where Chinese families don't sit around and do chit-chats. That's all I do. Is do chit-chats. That's all I am, is a chit-chatter. And there's a kind of a nasty word, bull, that fits that really well. But not Paul and his family. So if anybody in our family hears some rain outside, and someone says, gee, it's raining cats and dogs, all four of the Yangs. What did you say? Well, we said it's raining cats and dogs. Really? See what I mean? See what I mean? Well, we've got 50 expressions for just that alone, rain. And we understand it. Why? We're nuanced to it. Why? And so when I was a professor for 17 years, my American students were not nearly as good as students as my Asian students. Not nearly. But in an entrepreneurial project, oh my gosh, our youngsters know how to put A together with B and make C and sell it to D. See, the world, it's kind of a little bit of a misclaimer to say, give a man a fish and he eats for a day, but teach a man to fish and he eats for a lifetime. That's kind of true. But the world knows how to catch a fish. The world does not know how to sell a fish, to market a fish, to make a business come together by which a fries on any one day will have 65,000 items in that grocery store just ready for you to come and pick off a piece of it. You've got to be kidding. No one is smart enough to do that except for the free market. Bingo. No one knows how to do that unless you have, it's in your DNA of how to buy and sell and market and trade and specialize. That comes so hard if it isn't been in people's systems. The next years can be and will be terribly exciting. My biases, we need a new leader, but will a new leader do it and we're going to do more of the same? No. Did George Bush sign one, he didn't veto one spending bill in 8 years. So call George Bush what you want, good man, Christian, lovely, call him what you want, but don't call him a conservative. Please, please, I'm offended because George Bush did not veto one spending bill. In fact, he gave us a Medicare bill that was one of the highest cost items ever imposed on the American economy. But okay, so I'm done with George Bush. So if you think that necessarily Republicans are the answer, they're going to have to prove it to you and prove it to me. Come on. You had your chance. You had all of Congress. You had the Senate. You had the presidency. And spending went through the roof. So it's just too easy just to blame Obama on everything. It's just too easy. We've got to get our acts together. Well, maybe you'll tell Wayne when he comes back. That's Barry's first and last chance in 2013. But thanks, and I'll close in prayer. Father, I'm so thankful for this class. All the activities that this class does and some of the money that it raises for different projects, Lord, you've blessed them mightily, and you've given them just a prince of a guy. Thank you for precious Wayne and Margaret and what he means to all of us and what he means in your kingdom. We're grateful for our church. We're grateful for Sunday. We're grateful for taking a breath. We're going to ask your precious leading and care over our wonderful country. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.